I'm Alex Michelson. Welcome to the Issue Is podcast, one of the wilder political weeks we've seen in recent memory. Usually, when there's a vote on the floor of the House, the Speaker of the House will only call a vote if they know they have the votes to win. This week, there was no Speaker of the House, so they had to keep calling votes until there was one. Usually, the Speaker of the House is elected on the first ballot. This year, it took 15. It was the longest election for Speaker of House in over 100 years. And there were moments where it was unclear whether Kevin McCarthy of Bakersfield would end up as the Speaker of the House. In the end, he got there. It looked like Matt Gaetz might have been punched out before he got there, but Matt Gaetz eventually supported the plan to get McCarthy the speakership. And now he takes over from another Californian, Nancy Pelosi, of course, the last Speaker of the House. So on the show this week, we break it down analysis-wise with Brian Goldsmith and Joel Pollack, two of our favorite panelists. We'll hear from them in a moment. But let's start in Capitol Hill. Joining us via Zoom is Mike Garcia, Republican congressman from Santa Clarita, one of the folks who nominated Kevin McCarthy on this final day, and who was there for all the crazy. Congressman. With us now from Capitol Hill is Mike Garcia, Republican congressman from Santa Clarita. Congressman, what a week. You must be exhausted at this point. What is your big takeaway from this crazy experience you all have been going through?
Well, honestly, it's a continuation of everything I've seen. You know, I came in the middle of 2020, right in the middle of COVID, the pandemic, and the last 2.5 years has been pretty tumultuous. So this is just a continuation of that. It's been a little frustrating. I'm not going to lie. This isn't, you know, the ideal way to go about electing the next Speaker of the House when you just get the majority back. And it's been a lot longer than just the last 4 days. In fact, we've been going through these machinations for the last 2 months with our, Republican conference elections first, where Kevin McCarthy got about 90% of the vote then. It's a thin majority, and this is what happens when you don't have, these massive majorities. Everything's a negotiation. But in this case, I think this is better for the country in the end.
I know you've expressed your frustration with your Republican colleagues this week. A group of you came out. What did you say privately, internally? Did you ever go up to these people and just say, like, what the H, dude? Like, how was it? Take us inside the room a bit.
Yeah, and everyone, you know, it's amazing as disparate of a spectrum the political spectrum can be, right? From the most conservative to the most moderate, you also have that spectrum of personalities, and they're not always, you know, correlated to where they are on the political spectrum. So for me, I was just having conversations with human beings, because what you find out is sometimes it's the policies and the issues that they're concerned about. Sometimes it's a personal thing. They just don't like Kevin McCarthy. And sometimes they want to get to yes, but they haven't seen something. And one of the gentlemen I sat down with, he says, "Hey, I like what I'm being told. Just none of this stuff has been put in writing, and I just need to see it in writing, Mike." And later that night, the leadership was able to put in writing. This was last night, and he got comfortable and then changed his vote. And I think in the end, the most noble fights are the toughest ones, and not every victory is easy, but we're going to be victorious on this one.
Are you concerned, though, about the path forward in terms of actually governing? If getting the speakership was this hard, you're going to have to do this again to get stuff passed. And there are some that say that Kevin McCarthy may have given up a lot of his power in order to get this job, which might make being speaker harder. What do you say to critics that say getting stuff done is going to be almost impossible going forward?
Yeah, it's going to be difficult, no doubt. One of the rules is to allow just one person to vote to bring to a vote a motion to vacate the chair, which is the removal of the Speaker of the House, right? So this rule is like Kevin McCarthy dousing himself in fuel and then handing out 435 matches. And, it's going to be tough. And Matt Gaetz uses the metaphor, this is a straitjacket. I don't think it's that restrictive, but in the end, we need to be led by leaders who have pure and selfless intent, and we need a majority that governs in the same way. And I think we're going to be successful, but there's going to be some drama mixed in here once in a while, just like all families have.
Are you concerned that Matt Gaetz might light that match?
I think I'm concerned that anyone would light the match, and if they do, that there's going to be conversations. There's going to be dialogue, obviously, and this could slow down progress. So is the short answer. I'm concerned that if we don't communicate, that if we don't all get alignment, that anything, the renaming of a post office, right, in Santa Clarita could be a dramatic bill if five people decide that they want it to be a dramatic thing.
Because of all this drama this week, there's been like very little conversation about actual issues. But one issue that I know that you see as so important, and that is so important, is what's happening right now at the southern border. And President Biden is headed there for the first time of his presidency this weekend. What do you hope that he sees there?
Well, it doesn't matter what I hope he sees. I've been to the places he's going to now a couple of times, and I'll tell you what he is actually going to see. He's going to see Border Patrol facilities that are absolutely inundated with illegal immigrants. He's going to see Border Patrol agents that are spending more time processing these folks and in some cases sending them to the airports. He's going to see a humanitarian crisis that frankly brought me to tears when I saw it. I was in a facility outside of El Paso, just 3 miles north of the border, where I saw a five-year-old little girl unescorted, and she was escorting her two-year-old little brother. And I spoke to her in Spanish. She didn't speak a lick of English. And I asked her her situation. And she said that her family dropped her off with the cartel. The cartel dropped her off at the border. Border Patrol agents rescued her just on our side of the border. And she's been in this facility. She doesn't know what she's doing. She doesn't know where she's going or who's picking her up. And it was heart-wrenching, Alex. I literally was brought to tears. And it was probably one of the most powerful experiences in this office that I've seen. And so I hope he sees those things. I hope he doesn't see the political side of this, that this isn't a political thing. This is a humanitarian crisis, and this isn't good for the folks coming across the border. It's sad to me that this is the first time he's gone, but he doesn't actually need to go to understand that this is a problem.
This has been such a week that we want to end with something a little fun. We play something on this show called Personal Issues. This is your first time doing this on the show. It's 30 seconds to get to know some of your favorites. This is rapid fire, first thing that comes to mind. Okay, you ready?
Okay.
Here we go. What is your favorite TV show?
Big Bang Theory.
Favorite band or musician?
21 Pilots.
What's the best way to relax after a long weekend?
With my family and kids and just relaxing at home. That's about as good as it gets.
Do you have a favorite meal?
Sushi.
All-time favorite movie?
Probably Tombstone.
And who's your role model?
Our founding fathers. I never met them, obviously. but John Adams. I've read his writings. I've read his letters, his personal letters, and obviously his biographies. And he did it right. That's how I think this country needs to be managed, by people who have a lot of passion and purity of heart and sacrifice for the nation. But that's who I emulate.
Well, this week we are celebrating the life of one of my role models, Barbara Walters. She is probably the most significant female broadcast journalist in TV history. Opened the door for so many people. She was known for her legendary interviews. And so when I studied her, I realized there were three questions that she seemed to really enjoy asking in almost every interview that she did. So I was thinking, as a tribute to her, we ask you those and you get the Barbara Walters treatment. Maybe you'll cry. Okay, so you ready for this? What is your philosophy or motto?
I love this country. So the Constitution, capitalism, competition, and charity, what I call the four C's. Any problem that we have in our society or our government, we can solve them with the four C's if we just would sit down and actually pay attention to what those four C's mean.
What is the biggest misconception about you?
Well, there's a lot. Obviously, being a member of Congress in this modern era of social media, I think I'm portrayed as this very far right, crazy, all kinds of names that have been thrown at me. I think when the opposition first meets me and sits down with me, they go, "Wow, you're not this bad guy that your opponents try to make you sound like." And So there's a lot of misperceptions in this social media world.
And we
end by the way, I'm glad we have people like you, because you are objective and fair in your portrayal of not just the issues, but also the top of the people.
There we go. Bring more of that. Okay. We finish. This is her last question. This is her favorite question to end an interview on. Finish this sentence. Mike Garcia is
a patriot.
There we go.
A father.
Okay. Congressman, thank you very much for joining us in the midst of this crazy week. Up next, we're going to break down all of this with our panel. Brian Goldsmith and Joel Pollack will be here in studio. We go to break, though, with this image honoring Barbara Walters. On her final episode of The View, almost every major female national broadcast journalist in recent American history surprised her to say thank you. Here's how she described them.
I just want to say this is my legacy. This is my legacy. These are my legacy.
I have the record for the longest speech ever on the floor. I don't have a problem getting a record for the most votes for speaker, too.
Kevin McCarthy didn't quite make history on that front, but it has been quite a week for him. Let's talk about it all with our panel. Brian Goldsmith is a media consultant with Kona Media and advisor to Democratic candidates. For years, he worked with Katie Couric to co-host her podcast and help lead political coverage at Yahoo and CBS News. Joel Pollack is a senior editor-at-large for Breitbart News. He's also an author. His latest book is personal. It's a biography of his mother-in-law called Rhoda, Comrade Kadali. You are out of order. We'll talk more about that a little later on in the show. Two of our favorites, Brian, Joel, welcome. Good to see you both. Joel, let's start with you, because this is sort of your area of expertise, the modern conservative movement. What a week for the modern conservative movement. Take us sort of behind the scenes. What has this fight really been about, this Kevin McCarthy versus the rebels?
So I should state up front that I don't agree with the rebels, but let me put their argument as best I can. They're frustrated with the party establishment. They're frustrated with Washington. They don't trust the Republican Party leadership. And they're really angry about the omnibus spending bill that passed last year in the closing weeks. And this is how they're expressing it. They feel nobody listens to them. There's no debate. So they're really picking a fight with the leadership just to pick a fight. There aren't any policy or ideological differences between the mainstream of the Republican Party and this faction. This is largely about personalities. And if you want to be charitable, it's about a general sense of frustration with Republican leaders.
Brian, what do you make of all of this? We've never seen anything like this in our lifetime.
Well, some say this is about spending. It's clearly not about spending, because they were perfectly comfortable with Donald Trump's record-breaking spending. Some say that it isn't personal, but it clearly is personal, because, you know, it's about their perception of Kevin McCarthy's effectiveness or ineffectiveness as a leader. I think what it shows is that the entertainment wing of the party, that is much more focused on clicks and hits and profiting from conflict in Washington, is really in the driver's seat in the modern Republican Party.
Would you say that Matt Gaetz is a part of that?
I would.
maybe not serious policy issues being driven by him. So, Joel, how do you govern in this scenario? Because, you know, all these folks are still going to be there. Even the folks who reluctantly at the end of the week went to Kevin McCarthy, they still, you know, are prone to do this. Kevin McCarthy giving up a whole lot at the end of the week to get this job. How do you go forward and actually pass stuff?
It's a great question. The rebels have made it much more difficult for Republicans to govern. They have weakened the Republican caucus in Washington, and the Democrats are sitting back and enjoying the show, because not only are they frustrating Kevin McCarthy's legislative agenda, but they're sending a message to voters. Both parties are telling voters, Republicans are not serious about governing. This is a disaster, I think, for Republicans, because the people who voted them into office, not necessarily the activists or the people on social media, but the voters wanted to see action on the border. They wanted to see action on spending. They wanted to see action on inflation. And they're not seeing any of that. Now, maybe one or two votes you could forgive on the first day, but it's been a week now, and they're not going to get started on any of this stuff. Oversight, no Hunter Biden investigations, none of that. It's all delayed by a week, and that's a lot. So it's a real problem for Republicans as they go forward, because Democrats, I think, can rightly say, you gave them the majority and they wasted a week with this little squabble, and it's really bad.
I mean, Brian, not a good week for the Republicans when the Breitbart guy is saying that Republicans are not serious about governing, right? And also shows the contrast between Nancy Pelosi, who had the same margin and had very different results.
Well, comparing Nancy Pelosi to Kevin McCarthy as a legislative strategist and leader is like comparing, you know, Leonardo da Vinci to a three-year-old. But okay. what I would say on Joel's point is this is serious business. You know, it is amusing for Democrats to watch Republicans in a circular firing squad, but there are things that they have to do for the country. They have to raise the debt ceiling. They have to fund the government. They have to keep America running in the eyes of the world. And I have profound doubts that they're going to be able to accomplish anything. And McCarthy has begged and borrowed his way, apparently, to a victory here, but at a cost of his own capacity as a speaker. He may be the weakest speaker in American history after this.
I have to say, as a conservative Republican, it's very frustrating because the rebels have made it much harder for Republicans to govern. They've actually strengthened the Democrats and the party establishment. Mitch McConnell in the Senate can say, look at the circus over there in the House. You got to do things my way, which is the opposite of what the rebels say they want.
And quite a contrast to have Mitch McConnell with Joe Biden talking about legislative success at a bridge, talking about their infrastructure deal while all of this was happening. All right, our panel's sticking around. We've got more to talk about. We're going to talk about what's happening here in California, a big week for California politics. Governor Gavin Newsom inaugurated for a second time this week in Sacramento. He did it intentionally on January 6th and did a peaceful march to the Capitol to try to contrast with what we saw in Washington 2 years ago, almost like he's focused on a national presence or something. Back with our panel to talk about this, Brian Goldsmith and Joel Pollack. Brian, let's start with you. Just with the optics of that, Governor Newsom clearly trying to send a message. This isn't just about California. California is in a different place than the national Republican Party.
Well, 2 years ago, a mob that was formed and summoned and encouraged by the then president of the United States attacked not just the U.S. Capitol, they attacked democracy itself. And I don't think you can overstate that as a moment, as a problem, as a crisis in our country. And so I don't blame him at all for putting a spotlight on that. I credit him for doing that. Of course, that's not how he's going to be judged as governor. He's got serious stuff that he's got to address, the budget deficit, homelessness.
But Joel, what do you make of him choosing January 6th and leaning into this sort of national fight?
Well, Gavin Newsom has always been better at gestural politics than actually governing. And this is the latest attempt to do that, to pick a social or cultural issue and broadcast a kind of national presence. He clearly has political ambitions for the future. It's not about California. He doesn't really have a good track record as governor so far. The Legislative Analyst's Office this week came out and said that the state's targets for carbon emissions, climate change policy are very nice, but there's no plan to get there. And it's going to be a struggle to reach all these targets. He wants to shut down gas-powered cars. What does that mean for California businesses? So these are all serious questions that he's not addressing.
And Brian, one potential real challenge for Gavin Newsom in a second term that he didn't have in a first term is this idea that he could soon have a big budget deficit. You know, he had historic surplus. When you got $100 billion, you know, he literally joked that he was Oprah. You know, everybody, you get this, you get this,
it's
you get this.
It's fun to be governor with a surplus.
Right. And yeah. As we've seen from our previous governors, it's not so fun to be a governor with a deficit. Talk about that challenge for him, potentially. Projections show $24 billion deficit potentially this year.
Well, every challenge, every problem is also an opportunity. And it's an opportunity in this case to do something that is long overdue in California, which is fundamental tax reform, so that we're not so dependent on the stock market, that we're not so vulnerable to the booms and busts of the economy. I mean, when the country catches a little cold, California gets the flu. That's been true for a generation. He has the capacity, the legislative majorities now, to actually do something about this.
Next week on The Issue Is, Senator Alex Padilla will join us here in studio, as will actor and musician Dennis Quaid, who has a new documentary about our power grid. And we'll catch up with Second Gentleman Doug Emhoff, who is in town working on education issues with George Clooney. Almost as big of names on our panel this week. Brian Goldsmith, Joel Pollack back with us. Joel, you've got a new book out, which is very personal. We want to put the cover up on the screen right now. It's called Rhoda, a biography. It's about your mother-in-law. She is an impressive person. Tell us a little bit about this.
Well, Unfortunately, she passed away last year, and when she was diagnosed with cancer in September 2021, we sat down and said, we have to work on your biography together. And we did so. She was born in apartheid South Africa. She grew up in a segregated community. She was forcibly removed from the place they were living, and she became an anti-apartheid activist. She became one of the most prominent feminists within the anti-apartheid movement. And then when democracy finally came in 1994, she worked in Nelson Mandela's administration as a human rights commissioner. But she resigned because she felt that ruling party, the African National Congress, wasn't fulfilling its promises to voters. And she became one of the most important critics of the new government. And over time, her politics began to change. She became one of the most unlikely, perhaps, Trump supporters out there when she moved to LA. She understood Trump as a fighter against the establishment, and she was very much about blowing up establishments. So she had a very interesting perspective on politics and a fascinating life.
Kind of like you, right?
I guess so.
You used to be a far left activist, and now
she
on the
is
Trump
an inspiring
train.
Way figure for me, as and I think people will enjoy the book. They'll read her inspiring story, whether they agree or not. She loved a debate.
And speaking of loved ones, Brian, a happy birthday to you and your wife Claire. A big year for you guys right now, right?
Uh-huh.
And it's a big time to celebrate.
Well, I don't know that it's so big for me, but she had a big birthday. I'm older. She would be happy for our audience to know.
Okay.
But very sweet of you to point that out.
All right. Well, Claire Goldsmith, for people that don't know, is smarter than Brian and better in pretty much every way. So we want to end this week with a celebration of Claire. A happy birthday to her. Our thanks to Brian and to Joel and to Congressman Mike Garcia, and to you for listening. Who knows what's going to happen next week? It should be interesting. We've got Alex Padilla, the senator from California, supposed to come in. We also have with us Dennis Quaid coming in, and we'll be hearing from Doug Emhoff and George Clooney and the Secretary of Education about a real cool program happening in Los Angeles. For now, I'm Alex Michelson. See you next time for more The Issue Is.